Hey, John, it's James West.
Hey James, how you doing?
I'm doing well, and welcome everyone to the 45th installment of the Invest with James West podcast series. Today we have with us John Rogers, CEO of Locust Bioenergy. The company was formed only a few years ago by the guys that invented probiotics, which John joined in 2018 after a 30-plus year career in the energy business. He spent 9 years as the Global Technology Director for BP before serving as the Global Head of Oilfield Services at Clariant, where he worked extensively with chemical surfactant. Hydrates are a massive issue offshore with no best-in-class solution. While the industry has historically relied on surfactants to change the interface between oil to water or oil to rock, Locust Bioenergy is pioneering the use of biosurfactants made naturally by microbes to improve recoveries at a fraction of the cost. So, John, welcome again. So before we get into it, can you tell us why you decided to focus on biosurfactants after a long career that touched on a lot of different oilfield technologies?
Certainly. Well, throughout my career, I've lived most of the places in the world that can be considered the oil patch. I've always focused on oilfield chemistry, and the backbone of many of these chemistries that we use every day are surfactants. You know, they're very similar to what we use in domestic cleaning. They're sort of soaps. And what they do, as you mentioned earlier, they act at the interfaces, either between different fluids, trying to break up oil and water, or they work between, say, oil and the rock in the reservoir. And they're used to, for example, reduce the drag between the oil and the reservoir rock to mobilize more oil. They're also used in things like frac fluids, when we're trying to get that water to come back as soon as possible so we can start to produce oil. And the products that we're using today mainly have been around for, say, 100 years or so. But for several decades, biosurfactants have been attracting a lot of interest, especially in the technology and universities and the research area, as very promising alternatives to these petroleum-based surfactants. But that was really when people were only making them at the sort of petri dish level. But when they did that, they would analyze them and found out that these had some phenomenal properties. So, you know, apart from the green profile they have remarkably low dosage rates. And probably in any aspect that you could measure, they have either comparable or superior properties to synthetic surfactants. So obviously, as I mentioned before, everything that we try and do in the oilfield chemical business has really got the backbone of surfactants. But every one of these technical papers basically ended by saying nobody can make these products commercially at scale at a viable quantities and the correct price point for the oil industry.
Right.
And this is where my company, or the parent company, made these very complex molecules using a fermentation process. We can make them at scale, and we can make them at a fraction of cost of the biosurfactants that are currently used for some of these very high-end household cleaners or in personal care products.
Okay, so maybe we'll start off with what exactly is a biosurfactant, how is it made and used in the energy industry, and are they used commonly in other industries?
Great question. So biosurfactants, they've been perfected over millions of years of evolution. They allow microbes to survive in very hostile environment. And what they basically are, if you think of a yeast molecule, a yeast microbe, if you land on something, you've got to outcompete anything else, any other microbe that's trying to metabolize that potential food source, and you've got to be able to basically metabolize anything that you land on. So what these yeast microbes do is they exude this product called a biosurfactant, and say this yeast had landed on, say, a spot of fat or grease. Well, it's got to be able to break that piece of grease up into like a trillion pieces. It's then got to coat it almost like an M&M so that it can bring it across its cell wall and metabolize it. So the more effective that these biosurfactants are at doing that process, the obviously it's helped them to survive from the evolutionary point of view. Now, these biosurfactants are extremely complex molecules, much more complex than the traditional surfactants that we use. So they get these remarkable physical properties from this chemical structure, And as I say, the key is that some of these properties are also extremely valuable in the oil and gas industry. So if you think about the fact that we get paraffins and waxes, these products are tremendous at penetrating those wax deposits, breaking them up, and helping them to flow. So this is the potential that people recognize for quite a number of years with biosurfactants. Now, the other part of your question was, which other industries are they being used in? Well, that same mechanism I described, the ability to encapsulate molecules like an oil molecule or a paraffin molecule and transport it, is what the pharmaceutical industry is looking at for them to increase the efficacy of drug delivery. You know, could these biosurfactants actually coat a pharmaceutical drug and help it to get across the cell membrane into a human cell?
Okay, I think I understand. So what are the advantages and disadvantages of biosurfactants relative to normal surfactants? You know, and has it been a challenge to get the oil field to adopt these new technologies? Or I guess very old technologies?
Well, they offer, absolutely. Well, they got several advantages over normal chemical surfactants. First of all, they're environmentally compatible. They biodegrade in 30 days. They're extremely low toxicity. But the key thing for performance and efficacy in the oil field is the fact that they maintain their activity over extreme conditions of temperature. We've tested them to over 300 degrees F. They'll work in high salinity conditions. They'll work across a range of pH values. So they're much more robust than the traditional surfactants. The other thing which is unique is obviously an oil and gas reservoir is composed of a lot of minerals. These biosurfactants actually absorb onto many of these mineral surfaces and then slowly desorb. So the detergent effect that you're looking for to try and, you know, wash off more oil from that near-wall area like a detergent, not only do they need a small amount of product to do that, but actually that effect is maintained for several months. We've had applications in the Permian where we would put just one dosage in, and 7 or 8 months later, we're still seeing the surfactant coming back and giving us this increase in oil production that the operator was looking for.
Well,
but the final differentiator, and this is really when we come on to the future of oil and the shale revolution, is the extremely small size of almost like the droplet of the biosurfactant that you get in water. So let me explain that. So most of the shale reservoirs that we try and extract oil from, we only ever recover about 8 to 10% of that oil. And that really is because the pore size, in other words, the small pockets where this oil is trapped are just, you know, unbelievably small. Like in the Wolf Camp, these pore sizes are between 3 and 18 nanometers. So to give you an example, a human hair on that scale is 75,000 nanometers. And a human DNA is about 2.5 nanometers wide. So the oil is trapped in these absolute micro pores, and it's almost extremely difficult to get anything to penetrate that to remove the oil. So to give you an example, a traditional surfactant that we've been using for years, a synthetic surfactant, the so-called micelle, or the aggregate that you get, the dissolved droplet of these surfactants are about 100 nanometers. So, you know, typically 5 to 10 times the size of the natural pores in, say, the Wolf Camp shale in the Permian. So they cannot penetrate. Now, people have tried nanoparticles over the year. It's still something that people are looking at. But even the smallest nanoparticles are like 20 nanometers. They're only having relatively spread penetration. The size of the biosurfactant is an unbelievable 1.2 nanometers. So this explains some of the fantastic results we've been getting in shale reservoirs, because we believe with, you know, sufficient soak time, we can penetrate into even the smallest pore size, reduce that interfacial tension, or so-called capillary pressure, and basically mobilize more oil. So, you know, this is a I'll come on to in a second why as probably drilling is about to fall off in the shale, why this technology could be exactly the right fit for the you know, the post-COVID rebound in the oil industry.
Right. Okay. So is there a big difference between the use of biosurfactants in different operating environments? I mean, you touched on shale, but conventional versus unconventional, shallow water, deep water, vertical, horizontal?
Well, I mentioned before that the great thing is that we find that the products don't have to be sort of tailored for different environments. I mentioned before, if you're in somewhere like the Appalachia, which is extremely salty water, very high brine saturation, majority of surfactants just don't work. They won't actually go into the water. They precipitate out. So it's very difficult to get a normal surfactant to work. With the biosurfactants, they can go up to almost saturated brine and still be very effective. Also, when you go offshore, some of the deep water wells are very high pressure, very high temperature, and normal surfactants, again, they hit what they call a cloud point, where, again, the product starts to come out of solution. And we find that our product, again, has got these temperature and pressure and salinity. So it's a very broad brush that we've got. It seems to work in all conditions.
Okay, got it. Well, you have two products available now. I believe it's Assure EOR Flow, which targets paraffins that build up production tubing, and then Assure EOR Stim, which is used in conjunction with Assure EOR Flow to further stimulate the well. Are there different formulations for each product based on their targeted application?
They are. They all started off as a sort of variation on a theme. I mentioned earlier on that, you know, the way that a yeast actually makes a biosurfactant to help it metabolize organic matter. Well, that was the first application that we had. We realized that these products were fantastic wax dispersants. And basically, we could digest over 200 waxes in the U.S. We tried that. So we originally used these products, the Flow product, as basically paraffin dispersants. What we found was if we were soaking a well with a solution of our biosurfactant, wherever the biosurfactant would touch a producing zone, we would see a boost in production. So we realized that what was happening was the product was penetrating or imbibing in to the rock, and it was actually changing the interfacial tension, changing that drag between the oil and the rock, and producing more oil. So in over 300 wells where we tested, we had an average of 46% production increase just where we were applying the product initially as a wax dispersant, as a wax almost like a dissolver. So what we realized was that if we wanted to increase that stimulation effect, there was one particular biosurfactant in our blend which was extremely good at changing that wettability of the rock, and the other one was more focused on penetrating paraffin. So basically, depending on the formation, if it's a formation that's got a lot of paraffin, then we will have a certain blend that would maybe have more of the combined biosurfactant. If there's not a paraffin problem downhole, and we just will go to the stim. So we can sort of customize the product to get the benefit that they want based on the conditions downhole.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Could you talk about the recent work you guys did in the Wolfcamp and the success you saw there? And RC is still seeing there.
Absolutely. So we obviously took the data that we had from conventional wells. We took it to several operators who are working in the Wolfcamp, which is obviously one of the shale reservoirs. This was the Wolfcamp B. And we worked with a medium-sized operator there who had a series of wells. They were actually some of the first ever unconventional wells. They were actually vertical wells. And they'd seen a steady decline on this lease. It was a lease of 9 wells over the last couple of years. So the wells on this particular lease had an average of 6% decline year in, year out. So we came in July last year and basically just put one pill per month, not a continuous treatment, down the backside of each well, allowed it to soak in for like 4 to 12 hours, and then put the well back on again. Well, what we saw is we continued that treatment over 7 months, and we reversed a 6% decline into a plus 19% increase. And what we'll come on to is obviously this is phenomenal for an unconventional well. And what we really think is it's going to be a viable alternative to some of the high capex techniques that are out there, like CO2 injection or miscible gas, huff and puff. And this is a real low cost. So when we took it to the RRC, one of the senior people in the RRC actually said, you know, this is enhanced oil recovery for the small guy, for the small operator. So who doesn't have the money to put in the capex. So this was extremely promising. And as I'll come on to in a few minutes, the Railroad Commission recognized that technology as a tertiary EOR technology. And we've got a tax break.
But
typically, you've got 5 years to go back to the RRC and prove that you've had a change in production and you've positively influenced it. We were able to go back to the RRC in just 7 months on this lease because it was so clear-cut that we had a sustained production increase.
That's very impressive. So what inning would you say you're in terms of commercializing your products and other any more legal or qualifying hurdles into getting your products approved for use?
Because the products are basically almost food quality, like generally regarded as safe, there's no environmental issues or toxicity issues, etc. In terms of commercializing our products, the one of the things that we do is we do a lot of lab work and we do a lot of IP filing to protect the knowledge that we've got. That's what we think is going to be extremely good for us when we eventually go to sell this company or sell this technology at some later date. So we spend a lot of time understanding, generating lab data. So when we go to our customers, we've got a combination of lab data, we've got a combination of field data, and we're getting a lot of adoption. So at the moment, we've got our flow product, which is our part of our Assure EOR. It's part of the paraffin and stimulation product range. We've also got a range of products for the completion market, which we call in sustain. And again, these same characteristics we're talking about, they can be used everywhere from fracs through to wax dispersion production. But the big prize for us and for the industry is, can we help the shale industry to reverse the declines that it's going to have if we don't bring back drilling? So there are no sort of qualifying hurdles legally. There's a new technology adoption. There's a joke in the oil industry, it's the race to be second. So everybody wants to see great case histories and great lab data. And that's where we are in the process. We've got a series of six major horizontal well jobs planned in the next 2 or 3 months. And based on data from those, I think we're going to, there's a good chance we could go viral on this because there's so much interest from the big producers who are now actively looking for alternatives to just, drilling their way to extra production.
Sure. So costs are always a big factor in the business, and they will be, I'm sure, on the other side of the downturn as well. How does the pricing work for biosurfactants in comparison to normal surfactants? And is there also an opportunity to change the pricing structure so you benefit from the improved performance?
Well, the great thing is that our raw materials for these products, and this is why they're sustainable, are basically corn oil and sugar. And our manufacturing process, we believe, is the lowest cost in the world. If you couple this with the fact that our products work at a fraction of the dose of traditional surfactants, in some applications, we're using 1/50th of the dosage of a traditional surfactant. So you put those three together, and we're very, very cost-effective. So if somebody's using existing surfactant for whatever application, not only are we very attractive on the price per gallon, but the performance benefits they get are also extremely attractive. The other thing is that most of the synthetic surfactants that people use, our competition, at the moment are enjoying great pricing because they're all based on oil and oil prices relatively low.
Sure.
Where the supplier really hurts is when the oil price goes up, their raw material price goes up, and they try and pass on price to the oil companies, and that's when the oil company pushes back and they get margin squeezed. So I like to say that we're agnostic to the oil price because corn oil and sugar don't track the WTI.
Right. Okay, makes sense. Go ahead.
So I was going to say, you mentioned about alternative models. I mean, as you mentioned early on, I was in BP for 9 years, and so I've seen both sides of it. Alternative performance models are a fantastic idea. But gain share, or basically paying for performance, has been pretty hard to deliver. We'd absolutely be open for a performance contract where we were rewarded for the incremental oil. But so far, the industry, I don't think, has had widespread adoption of gain share.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. So you were just qualified, as you mentioned, by the Railroad Commission for an H-13 tax credit. Could you explain what that means and perhaps an example of the potential cost savings from that?
Absolutely. This, I think, is the most exciting part of all this. So about 20 years ago, before the shale boom, Texas was trying to encourage oil companies to come back and extract more oil out of Texas wells. So there's a Article 50 on the state statutes, which basically said any new technology, so anything except water injection, which is the traditional secondary recovery, would be considered for a tax incentive if it could demonstrate a positive response. So one of the technologies in the past that you may have heard of was called microbial enhanced oil recovery. And this has been known for about 70 years. This is when people would put microbes into a well and then basically feed them nutrients. And basically they would be producing these biosurfactants, these surface active agents in the well or in the water injection system, and it would mobilize more oil. So what we've done is really take that process from a hit-and-miss process in the ground. We actually ferment these same biosurfactants that we're trying to generate in the ground, but we do it in a completely controlled environment. So our fermentation centers basically look like microbreweries. Completely sterile. We produce this biosurfactant, which looks like maple syrup. There's no live microbes in it, and then we treat it just like a normal surfactant. So the biological aspect was known and approved by the Texas Railroad Commission. So about 2 years ago, we took all the case histories we had, and we said, look, we think this is a viable way of enhancing production. It's a tertiary enhanced oil recovery. So they approved this about 2 years ago through what they call an H-12, which says to the operators we're working with, this product meets the requirements of Article 50. And if you can demonstrate that you can change the decline curve of the lease, it's done on a lease basis, not individual well basis, then you can qualify for a 50% severance tax on all the oil produced, not just incremental oil, and you get that severance tax for 10 years, providing you carry on using the same treatment. So obviously, the severance tax is 4.66%. So we had our first H-13, we have several people who are in the process. They're applying for it. They're applying the chemistry. They're seeing the benefit. But as I mentioned, in the Wolf Camp example earlier, that was the 9-well lease with a medium-sized operator where the results was just so clear-cut that after 7 months, we took the data to the RRC, and in the May 5th commissioners meeting, they approved for this operator this H-13 tax break. So they will get a 50% severance tax break on all the production on that lease for the next 10 years. Now, to put that in perspective, if you look at an operator in Texas who is maybe doing 100,000 barrels a day, well, today's oil price of $38 a barrel, that's $32 million of tax break. But, bear in mind that obviously to get the tax break, we have to show a positive increase in production, and we're averaging about 19% increase. So then you come up to another $200 million plus of increased production. So as you can imagine, we're getting a lot of interest and a lot of calls from companies who want to understand how this works and how they can apply it in their Texas fields.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So the industry shut in a substantial number of wells during the downturn. Are you having conversations with potential customers about bringing those wells back on with the help of your biosurfactants?
Absolutely. I think people were definitely talking about, you know, how can I shut in my well? I think when the crisis was a little bit more unclear, say 4 to 6 weeks ago, and they were saying, okay, what can you do? So we were saying, okay, if you would inject in a solution of our biosurfactant, one of the things that we could prevent happening is possibly changing the wettability of that surface. So on oil reservoir is typically oil wet. We're trying to make it water wet so the oil can, this is very sort of general, can flow more easily. And some operators had concerns if they had extended shut-ins, could they have some damage, and would our biosurfactants help prevent that? We said yes. What people are asking now is that, when we come back on again, there was a fantastic article in Bloomberg a couple of weeks ago saying that, you know, shale is like opening up a bottle of shook up champagne. You get a tremendous initial fizz and then a very steep decline. And, basically, if you don't keep drilling, eventually the sort of 8 million barrels of shale that we're producing last year could very easily come down to, you know, 4 within 18 months if we don't carry on recompleting the duck wells or drilling more wells. So there's a lot of interest on, well, how can we get more out of our existing assets? I mean, so as I mentioned before, we get 8 to 10% of the original oil in place out to this thing now. What could we do as we start up again to try and get more oil out and maybe take our recovery rates up to 10, 12%? From 8 to 10%, so a lot of interest right. on that as an alternative, and the trials that we've got now with some very well-known operators is exactly that. They're evaluating what they can get from an intervention into a 2 or 3 year old well that's past its peak on the decline. If we were to apply a biosurfactant in water, what could we get back in terms of additional production? So that's very exciting for us.
Right.
Wow. And this effect has been seen a little bit because you remember the sort of controversy about frack hit wells where you'd have a parent well which maybe it had declined and the pressure had dropped and you'd drill a child well pretty close to it. Well, when you frack that child well, the rock that was joining or was adjacent to between the parent well and the child well, this depleted zone from the parent well was a low pressure point, and basically frac fluids could potentially penetrate into that well and cause all sorts of problems. So one of the things that they did to try and resist that was they were pumping down water with a little bit of surfactant in, a normal surfactant. Well, what they saw was when they brought those wells back up, they'd get a kick in production, but it would only last for a couple of days because I mentioned before, typical traditional surfactants don't retain on the rock. So another project we're looking at is frac hit protection, because if we can soak that parent well for a number of days and let that product imbibe in, it will stick. So when they bring that well back, the surfactant won't come back like a tsunami like it does with a synthetic surfactant. You know, we've got high hopes that we can maybe maintain increased production for numerous months after that frac hit treatment. But as I say, so the big thing is what can surfactants do as a low capex way of closing that gap they're going to have between production that they need to have and minimizing the drilling they have to do.
Sure, that's fascinating. We started talking about frac hits on our side back in 2016. I remember investors thought we were crazy; it would never happen, and of course, we had a problem, and it's great that we're finding more and more solutions to that. So maybe last one, John, for me, obviously you guys operate in Texas, you mentioned Appalachia. Where do you operate currently, and how quickly can you expand and scale this business?
Right. Well, again, my thought is that the secret sauce that we bring to the party, James, is really the chemistry. We operate directly, as you mentioned, in Midland, and we operate in Appalachia. What we don't want to do is we want to remain an asset-light business. So we know that our secret sauce is our chemistry. It's the patents around it, the IP, it's the application knowledge we've got. So what we want to do to be able to scale is we want to work through some of the biggest service companies out there. So, for example, in the drilling additives business, we don't want to set up our own sales force that's doing that. We want to work with the industry leaders. We want to give them our formulation knowledge. They will put in to enhance their products. They will put in to reduce the cost of their products. We're also working in some of the more remote basins like the Bakken. We're working through some of the market leaders there, and we're saying, you know, we'll provide chemistry, we'll provide the application knowledge, and this gives them a differentiated take to their customers. So we want to remain asset light. The great thing about our fermentation technology is it's modular. So we can take a plant that makes, you know, tens of thousands of gallons of this product a month. We can put a new plant anywhere in the world, certainly anywhere in the U.S., within 6 months. We've got a standard sort of template. We can move it. And so our model is built to scale. But what I don't want to do is, you know, my previous role, we had a business that was $300 million in the U.S. We had 1,000 people and 800 trucks and 45 depots.
Right.
We don't have a differentiator in trucks. So anybody who's going to come in when we do an exit on this, they'll probably have their own trucks. What they really want is our products. They want our IP. They want our formulation know-how. So it's a way of getting routes to market as quickly as we can, but without us incurring a large setup costs.
John, this has been a fascinating conversation. Congratulations on the early success you guys have had. I look forward to following the journey of biosurfactants, which I now know so much about that I didn't know earlier, which was zero. But I look forward to following the company and seeing you guys grow. Congratulations, and thanks for joining me today.
Well, thanks for the opportunity, James. I really appreciate it. And every morning, I always say the Evercore report is on my must-read list.
Well, thank you for that. Okay, John, take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
John, you still there?